Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Managing Treatment Side Effects, Aches and Pains from Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, or MPNs. And we're this is such an important program and one that we actually don't get to offer that often, so we're delighted to be able to offer this program today. And today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline and an educational grant from Morphosis US, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to mention that we have over 200 participants on this program today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, and suburban areas, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Australia, Bahrain, Canada, India, the territory of Virgin Islands, and United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and it's a pleasure to have all of you on the call today that you've taken this time to spend with us on this call today to learn more about how to manage aches and pains and side effects, treatment side effects from MPNs. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Aaron Gerds. And Dr. Gerds is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology, Deputy Director for Clinical Research, Cleveland Clinic Tosic Cancer Institute, Medical Director, Case Comprehensive Cancer Center, Clinical Research Office, Principal Investigator, Case Lead Academic Participating Site. And I would, Dr. Gerds will be addressing a review of the treatments of polycythemia vera, PV, essential thrombocythemia, ET, and myelofibrosis, MF, and common treatment side effects. He will also be discussing reducing complications of myeloproliferative neoplasms, what you need to know and do. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Gerds.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for joining us today. That's certainly a very kind introduction, and we certainly have quite a bit of stuff to cover in today's discussion. I just want to make sure before we go any further, in terms of the timing of the program, do you want me to discuss all those things all at once, or is it kind of a back and forth with Dr. Bose and Gowan?
No, actually, you will be discussing, each of you will, each presenter will be presenting their topics, so our audience will then have,
excellent,
there'll be a time for questions at the end, but not at the end of your presentation,
yeah,
so we can actually finish all the presentations and then go
and
on
then
to
we'll
the
do the Q&A. Okay.
Thank
I
you.
Will,
thank you.
I will get on with things then. all right. So certainly the treatment of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs, has evolved over the last even few years, and that's really exciting to see. You know, for a long time, this was a set of diseases that were somewhat, you know, marginalized or even ignored in medical circles. It was just, you know, patients had high blood counts, they had maybe had clots or could get leukemia, and there wasn't really a lot really understood about them or, you know, rational treatment approaches. And things started to change in the 1970s when this group came together called the Polycythemia Vera Study Group. And that was really a key event when a group of experts interested in these diseases came together and said, you know what, we need to learn more about these diseases, you know, move beyond what Osler observed a century ahead of time, and really understand the biology and modern treatments for this. And out of the Polycythemia Vera Study Group came a number of trials, in MPNs, as well as, you know, just basic things like definition of what a disease is. Up until then, you know, diseases like myelofibrosis had 20 to 25 different medically accepted names. And so you can imagine how confusing these things were. And so, again, I point to this as really a watershed moment for the field. Out of the polycythemia vera study group, you know, important trials looking at hydroxyurea, still a mainstay of treatment today, came out of and really start to pave the way for the concept of controlling blood count in MPNs in order to reduce disease risk going forward, particularly thrombosis risk. The second most important watershed moment, in my humble opinion, was the discovery of JAK2V617F mutations recurring in patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms. You know, back in the late 50s, this guy named William Demeshek, kind of a Illuminati in our field, if you will, it proposed that, you know, these diseases are so closely related, there must be some sort of pathobiology that links them all. But it wasn't until the end of 2004, beginning 2005, when groups identified the fact that half the patients with DT and half the patients with myelofibrosis and almost all patients with polycythemia vera will have this one particular mutation inside the cells driving the disease. And that was certainly a watershed moment as well, where we understood that there was a mutation that led to uncontrolled growth of cells. So by definition, we could start to call this a cancer, and justifiably so, and also kind of focused our treatment efforts on blocking this, the results of this mutation, the constitutive activation of JAK-STAT pathway. So not only did we recognize clinically that all these diseases are very similar, but we recognized on a genomic and biologic level that all these diseases are interconnected. And starting to understand why they happened, what was going on under the hood of these cells, really led to a discovery of new therapies and information that we are still unraveling today. On the heels of the discovery of recurrent JAK2 mutations, medications called JAK inhibitors were developed. And so really that led to the first approval for therapies here in the United States for MPNs, the JAK inhibitors namely. And so I think that's a really, really exciting development. Of course, there are lots of other treatments, other pathways, all kinds of other biology that we could talk about within these diseases. But to me, those are really two important events that have happened in the history of MPNs. And rooting out of that first one, the polycythemia vera study group, you know, they kind of came up with a definition for what to call these diseases. And I think really that's all this breaks down to is what is it, how bad is it, and what are you going to do about it? So the first thing is, what is it? Well, there are defined criteria to diagnose PV, ET, and myelofibrosis. The key pieces for polycythemia vera are an elevated red blood cell count, namely measured by hemoglobin, combined with a suppressed erythropoietin level. That's kind of the regulator of red cell production in the body. Moreover, we'd want to look in the bone marrow and see that there are changes consistent with polycythemia vera, lots of red cell precursors and the like, and no alternative explanation for why the red cells might be elevated. In essential thrombocythemia, likewise, we want to see a bone marrows with lots of, you know, platelet-making cells that don't look quite right. We want to see patients with elevated platelet counts that are not otherwise explained. And in myelofibrosis, we also see these kind of same features, where the platelet-making cells are abnormal, but the key difference in the bone marrows of patients with myelofibrosis is the fact that we see scar tissue, significant amounts of scar tissue in the bone marrow. Hence the name myelo meaning bone marrow and fibrosis meaning scar tissue. In addition to making the diagnosis of myelofibrosis, we want to look, is the patient anemic? Do they have immature white blood cells circulating around the bloodstream and the like? And that can help pull together that diagnosis of myelofibrosis. But in all of these diagnoses, again, we reflect on that second kind of key event, the presence of a JAK-STAT activating mutation. And those are mutations, again, in JAK2, calreticulin, another gene that can lead to JAK-STAT activation, as well as MPL, yet another gene when mutated can lead to JAK-STAT activation. So all three of these diseases are diagnosed in a very similar manner and have certainly overlapping in diagnostic criteria or diagnostic checkboxes that we check when we're making the diagnosis. But they are somewhat distinct entities, and we recognize them as such because the treatment approach for PV is different from ET, is different from myelofibrosis. So the second part of moving on into the path, you know, kind of the path of MPNs is the how bad is it question. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that PV, ET, myelofibrosis are cancers. They're types of blood cancers. In fact, they're types of chronic leukemias. But there are no stages for these diseases. You know, for example, when someone has breast cancer, we know if the cancer has traveled from the breast to the lymph node to organs or to the brain, we know it's stage 1, 2, 3, 4. And we intuitively know that stage 1 is less aggressive than stage 4, and we have very different treatments for the for the different stages of cancers. But your blood is everywhere, and so using a geographically based staging system would not be very helpful. So we use these things called prognostic models, where we take clinical and pathologic factors, and each are assigned points, and we add up the points, and then a risk score is then applied to that individual's disease at the time. And that's important because we can identify patients whose disease might be more aggressive versus those whose patients whose disease might be less aggressive. And patients with more aggressive disease, intuitively, we would use more aggressive treatments. And patients who have less aggressive disease, we would use less aggressive treatments to kind of match the needs for that individual. So after you find out what it is, then you got to be sure of how bad is it, and then you move on to what you're going to do about it. For polycythemia vera, the what you're going to do about it, you know, it's really kind of what I like to say are the two truths, if you will, of polycythemia vera treatment. One is the use of low-dose daily aspirin. This is based on a big clinical trial that was done several years ago called the ECLAP study, where half the patients with polycythemia vera got aspirin, half did not, and aspirin reduced the relative risk of a blood clot or blood clot-associated death by half. The second truth of treating polycythemia vera is get the hematocrit under 45%. And this came out of a more recent study called the CYTO-PV trial, where half the patients, their hematocrit goal was keeping it under 45. The other half, you know, 45 to 50, so tight control versus loose control. Tight control led, again, to a 50% relative risk reduction of a blood clots and blood clot-associated death, the most common complication of polycythemia vera. And I think we've kind of hinged all of our treatments going forward for polycythemia vera in those two kind of principles. Now, whether you use medicines to do that or phlebotomies or a combination thereof, you know, I think there is room for some debate there on what to do. But that being said, everything, again, is kind of rooted in the fact that we use low-dose daily aspirin or some antiplatelet agent in combination with keeping the hematocrit under 45%. For essential thrombocythemia, it's a little bit hazier. There was one trial done several years ago which in high-risk, what were felt to be high-risk ET patients, you know, half were given hydroxyurea, half were not, and it did show that maybe hydroxyurea was better, you know, reducing the risk of blood clots. This study was repeated in low-risk patients and showed no benefit. And so largely for essential thrombocythemia, we try to understand who's at a high risk for clot and use medicines to lower their blood counts. In patients who are less than high risk, we often say, well, let's just treat you symptomatically. If you're otherwise asymptomatic, we continue with careful observation. But if you are symptomatic or, again, have high risk for clots, we do intervene with medications to control the platelet counts. The third group of patients, myelofibrosis, is a little bit trickier. You know, we definitely have risk models to assess risk, but treatment decision initially is often driven by presence of symptoms or splenomegaly. So if a patient with myelofibrosis, independent of their disease risk, has a really big spleen or has a lot of symptoms related to their disease, we often use treatment because the treatments that we often use and are FDA approved to treat myelofibrosis are JAK inhibitors. And the main goals of the trials that have been done with these JAK inhibitors are to show that JAK inhibitors can shrink spleens and improve symptom burden. So really the question for a patient with myelofibrosis is focused mostly on splenomegaly and symptom burden rather than disease risk. Of course, disease risk is incredibly important in myelofibrosis because in patients who have high disease risk in myelofibrosis, we consider allogeneic transplantation. Some call it bone marrow transplant or stem cell transplant, but the transplant of hematopoietic material is the only treatment that we have today that has curative potential for MPNs. Of course, we are working hard to put transplanters out of business by designing new therapies and doing new clinical trials, but as of today, that is the only curative therapy. So in patients with high-risk myelofibrosis who are predicted to have a shorter survival, without transplant, we want to consider transplant for those patients because it is, again, the one thing that could potentially cure this disease. And really that's kind of the basic framework for the diagnosis, risk assessment, and treatment of myelofibrosis. And if you kind of follow that pattern of what is it, how bad is it, and what are you going to do about it, you can kind of arrive at a direct and complete plan. And every visit, you're kind of reassessing those things. Has something changed? Has the disease changed in some way? Are the counts out of control now? Has the spleen grown? Have the symptoms changed? And so you kind of go through that process all over again at every visit. And so certainly, you know, I encourage patients to kind of work through that process with me at every visit. Okay, what is this? How bad is it? And what are we going to do about it? And that kind of keeps us heading true in the right direction, visit over the course of one's disease. That was a lot. Deep breath.
All right, that was fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Gertz. That was an amazing presentation, and I know you really set the stage for today's program and gave people a lot of information, and also I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, so really a stellar presentation, and thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Prithvi Bose, and Dr. Bose is Professor, Department of Leukemia, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Bose will be addressing key concerns to discuss with your doctor and healthcare team, including treatment side effects and symptoms requiring immediate attention between appointments. And he'll also be discussing keeping a journal of specific side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain to report to your doctor. It's now my great pleasure to introduce to you my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bose.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Thank you for having me. That was indeed a fantastic overview by Dr. Gertz. That was quite daunting when I heard Dr. Messner lay out the agenda for him, and to do that in 9 minutes was amazing. So what I'm going to do then is get into some of the more granular details now that the stage has been set by Aaron, and go over some of the side effects, as we talked about, of the commonly used drugs. And then, as Dr. Messner alluded to, the importance of tracking symptoms over time, et cetera. So speaking of side effects, so there are 5 approved drugs, if we think about PV, ET, and MF. These are, again, the 5 that are specifically FDA approved. Things like the 4 JAK inhibitors that Dr. Gertz alluded to, for myelofibrosis, one of them also for polycythemia vera, and then an interferon formulation, Besremi, for polycythemia vera. There's also drugs that have been used over the years, may not be specifically approved, things like hydroxyurea, and then danazole, erythroid-stimulating agents for anemia. Anagrelide is a platelet-lowering agent which actually does have an approval specifically for ET. So those are sort of the, often used but not necessarily on-label drugs. Again, very important and have been the cornerstone really for many years until we got into the more recent era with all the drug approvals. So starting with the JAK inhibitors, you're probably familiar the most with ruxolitinib. This drug has been around since 2011 now for myelofibrosis and 2014 for polycythemia vera. Extremely well-tolerated drug in general, but can cause some problems, which really one should be aware of. So one recommendation I have for all my patients is get your Shingrix vaccine. Shingrix is this inactivated shingles vaccine. If you're going to take ruxolitinib or Jakafi, because shingles is a known risk. Reactivation of shingles is something that can happen because of the immunosuppressive effects of ruxolitinib. Also important to realize that this drug can cause weight gain, not too frequently, but it can become a problem for some patients. And then also it can increase the risk of skin cancer. Fortunately, not melanoma, but the less dangerous, if you will, but still significant, basal cell and squamous cell cancers, particularly in people who have a history of those, ruxolitinib can certainly increase that risk. And there are some situations where this is, again, admittedly rare, but there are some situations where it may not be tenable to continue ruxolitinib, if the skin cancers are becoming really kind of going out of hand. So those are 3 big ones for me for ruxolitinib. I mean, there's other things like, headaches, bruising, and dizziness, but those are not as bothersome in my experience or as much of a problem, even though they may be common, in terms of how many patients experience them. But I think the weight gain, the shingles, the skin cancers do become issues from time to time. Now, fedratinib was the next JAK inhibitor approved for myelofibrosis. That was 2019. And with this drug, you get a significant amount of gastrointestinal issues, particularly in the first month. So diarrhea, nausea, and having the loperamide or the ondansetron handy is really important because you don't want to allow those things to impair compliance with the drug. Fedratinib is a really good drug in terms of what it is supposed to do in terms of spleen and symptoms, spleen and symptom control. But again, these GI side effects can be a problem early on and dissuade some patients from staying on it, and therefore it's important to mitigate those. Now, also very important to mention, fedratinib has a very rare but important warning associated with it, of what is called Wernicke's encephalopathy, which is a rare nervous system complication caused by a deficiency of thiamine. So it's become common practice for many of us now to just routinely supplement thiamine in patients who are starting on fedratinib. That's not a mandate, but I understand that it's become quite common. Pactinib was approved in 2022 for patients with myelofibrosis and very low platelets. This is a drug that can cause diarrhea in up to 48% of patients in the first 8 weeks. So again, similar sort of to fedratinib, although this is more diarrhea, less nausea, but important to have that loperamide handy, anticipate this, be aware of this, et cetera. Also, pacritinib, there is something to be said about patient selection. You probably don't want to be on a blood thinner if you're on pacritinib or on another medication that prolongs the cardiac QT interval, which is an interval on the EKG that we watch and that the FDA also watches, because there could be complications, potentially serious ones, if pacritinib is combined with agents that can cause bleeding or can cause prolongation of that interval on the EKG. The most recent drug approval in myelofibrosis is momelotinib. Now, these all are JAK inhibitors, as Dr. Gertz was alluding to, and they work, I should add, irrespective of the driver mutation. Dr. Gertz talked about JAK2, CALR, and MPL, and regardless of whether you have one of these or which one or none of these drugs still work. So momelotinib was approved in September of last year. Now this one, again, important to mention something somewhat unique. This drug can cause a first dose effect where you can feel dizzy, have some flushing, blood pressure can fall. This is really a first dose effect, and some have suggested holding your blood pressure medication if you take one, and certainly staying well hydrated when you start momelotinib. Otherwise, a generally well-tolerated drug, but can drop platelets, can cause some infections, can cause some degree of peripheral neuropathy, and occasional liver enzyme issues. So again, things that your doctor will watch, but that first dose effect probably important to know about. I alluded to Besremi or Ropeg interferon alpha-2b. As a approved drug for PV, polycythemia vera. It's been a little over 2 years now that this drug came on the market. A better tolerated is our general perception than interferons in general. But again, with any interferon, flu-like symptoms are possible, depression is possible, and important to watch for. People with autoimmune disease probably may not want to go on interferons, or at least it should be looked at very very closely. Liver enzymes also can go up on interferon formulations, including Besremi. So that's something, again, for the physician to really watch. So those would be, at least for the five more recently approved drugs, those would be, I think, the top side effects that come to mind, and warnings, et cetera. Now, speaking of symptoms, there is, of course, There have been multiple symptom assessment tools. You know, we owe this work to, to doctors Ruben Mesa and his mentees Robin Sherber and Holly Geyer years ago. It's become common practice to use these both in the clinic on an everyday basis as well as in clinical trials. So some of you may be familiar with some of these instruments. There's things like the MPN-SAF symptom assessment form or myelofibrosis symptom assessment form. And what some institutions are starting to do, including our own, is really to send you, in advance of your clinic visit through the electronic medical record, these questions, to fill them out, and they all, get a score. The most convenient one has 10 items, and you just score them from 0 to 10, and that just helps the physician keep track over time of how you're doing with your symptoms. Again, as Dr. Gertz eloquently put it, it's about what is it, how bad is it, and how and what do we do about it. So this really helps to have that longitudinal assessment. As you are on a certain therapy to see how things are moving along. I think I'll stop there and, turn it over to Dr. Gawain. Hopefully that was helpful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Just a superb presentation, as always, Dr. Bose, and just wonderful information for people. Also, incredible information about how to handle side effects. It's really so thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A, just a stellar presentation, thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Christina Gawain. Dr. Gawain is Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Program Director, Hematology Oncology Fellowship Program, Founder Director, Integrative Medicine and Hematology Oncology Fellowship, University of Arizona, University of Arizona College of Medicine, Tucson, Arizona. And Dr. Gawain will be addressing Know the Warning Signs of Potential Medical Emergency and What to Do. And she'll also be discussing how being more assertive may improve your care and quality of life. It is my pleasure now, great pleasure to introduce to you my esteemed colleague, Dr. Gawain.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Messner, for that very kind introduction. And I want to thank you, Dr. Gertz and Dr. Bose, for such a beautiful and eloquent presentation. And you accomplished so much in such a short period. And I certainly wanted to spend a moment to honor everybody who is on the call today around the world, who you all are really committing to your own healthcare, and this is already being assertive. You're being proactive and really learning about your disease. And so I want to congratulate you and honor you and hopefully empower you to continue on the same trajectory. So MPNs, as you many of you know, are associated with medical emergencies. And so it really is critical to be aware of what are those medical emergencies, what are some of the signs and symptoms of these medical emergencies, and then what do you do about them? And so many of these medical emergencies are truly related to the formation of blood clots, and Dr. Gertz has spoken a little bit about this. So many of these symptoms that we're looking out for are really related to these blood clot formations. So symptoms such as a pulmonary embolus or a blood clot in the lung may have association with breathing abnormalities, right? Chest pain, shortness of breath are certainly signs and symptoms that we want to take very seriously in all of the MPNs. And so that would be either an ambulance phone call or directly to the ER if you were to experience those kinds of symptoms. Certainly, strokes are also a concern, and so that is a blood clot in the brain. And so what would that really look like? things like changes in your mental status, and I'm also speaking to caregivers out there, right? So if you see this in a loved one, unusual behavior, confusion, difficulty answering questions, or really just not behaving how they normally do, we want to really take that seriously and take them straight to the ER. Certainly fainting or loss of consciousness, sudden onset of dizziness or weakness or changes in vision, unusual headaches, inability to speak, all of these signs and symptoms may be representative of a stroke and evolution, and this is critical, and time is so, so critical. And so at the very first onset of these kinds of symptoms, you really want to be heading to the ER or making that 911 phone call. Another type of blood clot is a blood clot in one of our extremities. And so whether that be most commonly in the leg, but sometimes in the upper extremities. So that really presents with redness or swelling or pain in that extremity. And there are certain things that can provoke them, such as a long car trip or a long plane travel. Sudden severe pain anywhere in the body really should be prompted to undertake some sort of evaluation in the emergency department or in urgent care. Rarely and paradoxically, you can actually have bleeding complications with NPNs. And so you should be aware of that. If there's any uncontrolled bleeding, such as a nosebleed, or if there's gastrointestinal bleeding, which often is represented by black tarry stools, then that should be undertaken pretty seriously in the ER as well. So I'd like to empower you again to be prepared for if those kinds of signs and symptoms do occur, what do you do? Well, I think some of the proactive steps that you can really take is to determine already what is the location and what is the quickest route to an emergency department around you. So know where you would have to go if something were to occur. Another little tip is to keep these emergency phone numbers posted in your home where you can actually see them very visibly in an emergency and have access to them. And so other types of phone numbers besides all of your loved ones, right? So many of us actually we don't remember our cell phone numbers and our loved ones anymore, so actually writing them down, putting them on a sticky note can be helpful. Neighbors' phone numbers, et cetera, for loved ones. But other important numbers are police department, ambulance, certainly your healthcare provider phone numbers are all very important to keep around. If you are an older adult, another key component you may want to consider is to have one of those medical alert bracelets or devices in case there were a fall or an emergency and you're home alone. One particular scenario I want to bring up is really mental health disorders. And we do know in MPN patients there's a higher risk of these kinds of disorders. And so depression and feelings of wanting to harm oneself is truly a medical emergency. And so if you or a loved one are experiencing these kinds of symptoms, do know that there are supportive networks out there, and I'll give you a couple. You can call or text 988 or 1-800-273-TALK. We're a couple of resources, and I'm sure their Cancer Care Network also has wonderful ones on their website. But I just want to bring that up because I think that's really not discussed enough in the population. Okay, so hopefully you feel empowered and know now what are some of the medical emergencies out there, how do you recognize them, and how do you truly be prepared if they were to occur. I am also an integrative oncologist, and so I really love to focus on lifestyle maneuvers as well as supportive care modalities to really promote your care. And I think this is one area where you can be assertive and proactive in managing your quality of life and promoting your quality of life, decreasing your symptom burdens, and really improving your disease outcomes. And the title of this program is really Managing Aches and Pains. And I think by our lifestyle and some of these complementary modalities, it really can be a great asset to complement your MPN journey. And so looking at your diet and nutrition and really undertaking an anti-inflammatory diet can be beneficial. Certainly physical activity, so regular exercise can help with fatigue, improve cardiovascular health, which is so, so important in PV and ET, and can actually help manage those aches and pains that we're all concerned with. We've done trials even in things such as meditative movement and yoga. So in as little as 40 minutes per week of yoga, there was actually improvements in symptom burden, as well as some of the anxiety and stress that's associated with the disease. Stress management is so, so important as well. And we know stress really manifests as inflammation in our body, and inflammation causes pain. And so managing the stress, however that works for you, with things like meditation, deep breathing techniques, can be very, very helpful. Avoiding alcohol and tobacco is also a very important lifestyle maneuver that makes you feel better overall, but also potentially can help manage some of your cardiovascular risk factors. So always want to mention that. Sleep is also so incredibly important. So really looking at something called sleep hygiene, making sure you're promoting your best sleep possible and really making an effort to put that a priority is so, so important. Social support and mental health is incredibly important and also can help your symptom burden. And so focusing on community around you and being sure that you're engaging in health and wellness to promote mental health wellness is so critical. In regards to some supportive care therapies, other things are out there, such as acupuncture, and although we have no randomized phase 3 clinical trials in MPNs yet for things like acupuncture and massage, we do have some data for other cancer types, such as breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, and we do see that it decreases inflammation in many, as well as certainly can help manage aches and pains. So you can certainly consider other adjunct therapies such as that to really address your symptom burden. And so I think I will stop there, and I again want to thank everyone for attending today's program. I really appreciate your proactivity and look forward to questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gowan. That was really a superb presentation. Just really excellent, stellar, and actually covering a lot of important areas and giving people a lot of information about how to handle any type of emergencies or things that might arise. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And also, you're talking about how to improve people's quality of life was incredibly helpful, too. The whole thing was wonderful. So, okay, so we'll look forward to the Q&A, which is coming up soon. And before we move on to the Q&A, I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide a host of free services to people living with all types of cancer, including MPNs, of course. And we offer a practical financial and co-payment assistance. So that's incredibly helpful to people who are struggling with, of course, the cost of care, as well as people struggling with food insecurity, so that we definitely are there for you in that respect. We also offer support. So we have a helpline, 1-800-813-4673. And people in the United States do call that number quite frequently, and the phones are answered by oncology social workers. We have about 40 of them. And they are in queue waiting for your call so that nobody has to wait to speak to someone. So the wait time is, you know, we try to get rid of the wait time as much as possible. And people call for support. They call with questions. And the oncology social worker really addresses what the person's concern is. It might be about transportation to treatment. It might be about joining a support group. It could be a whole host of issues that they're struggling with. And so we do initially address their question and then review with them all the services we offer. So the additional services we offer are, we offer support groups, online support groups. Many people find those very helpful. And those groups are for every type of cancer, so MPNs included. also for young adults, older adults, middle-aged adults, caregivers, LGBTQ community. We offer these online groups for, we have really lots of online support groups. And you can see all the different types we have by going to our website, www.cancercare.org. Now, we also offer these educational programs and publications. And we also have coping circles and also resource navigation. So if we don't have the resource that you need, we will find one in your community. And it could be things, additional help around, let's say, food insecurity, not having funds for food. And it could be both in your city, in your region, in your state, or nationally. So our resource navigators will stay with you until they get you the resource that you needed. So that's just a thumbnail sketch of the services that Cancer Care offers, and please take advantage of them. I hope this is helpful to you. And now we're going to bring all of our speakers on board, and I'm going to ask Regina to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only, and you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So we have quite a few questions. Question for Dr. Bose. I was recently diagnosed with PV and am experiencing tremendous fatigue. What are some recommendations for combating fatigue?
So unfortunately, that's probably the absolute hardest of all the symptoms that we encounter. And it's also the most common. So, fatigue is uniformly the most common symptom in all three of the classic MPNs. I would not say that there is any particular drug that is very helpful for fatigue. The JAK inhibitors that we talked about, address a lot of different symptoms very well, but I don't consider fatigue to be one of them. I think, perhaps Dr. Gawin, with her integrative medicine background and experience, can help us more with this particular question. I really don't think pharmacologic therapies are that helpful.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Bose. Dr. Gawin, would you like to add something for this question of fatigue?
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bose, and I agree that lifestyle medicine really can be helpful here, and really one of our best evidence-based strategies for the management of any cancer-related fatigue is actually, and paradoxically, exercise. So it's the last thing on earth you want to do, but it actually is the most evidence-based strategy to deal with cancer-associated fatigue. So whatever you can do to get moving is very helpful. We have, as I mentioned, looked at yoga as a symptom management strategy, a non-pharmacologic symptom management strategy, and although it was not significant for fatigue, there was some effect for fatigue. And I will also say anecdotally, it can be quite helpful in some. Certainly looking at stress, right? Stress can be a huge driver of our fatigue, and very much of our MPN-related fatigue, however, is physiologic, right? It's all of those cytokines running amidst all of our bloodstream, but stress plays in too. So how are you managing stress? Are you recognizing stress? So A, becoming aware, and then B, having strategies in your back pocket that are well-sharpened tools, such as breathing techniques and meditation, which both, by the way, get stronger and more powerful over time, the more they're practiced, are really, really helpful to continue to improve your fatigue strategy. Looking at concurrent medical problems, I always want to mention that. So making sure, for example, that your thyroid is optimally functioning, that you don't have concurrent depression. These kind of things can really exacerbate your fatigue. And then as far as a pharmacologic strategy that I do in some who have very refractory fatigue is methylphenidate at a low dose in the morning. So that can be something that you can certainly talk to your healthcare provider about.
Excellent. And actually, as a kind of a it's a similar but different question. So I'm going to give this to Dr. McGowan as well. How can diet impact or relieve MPN side effects? I've been experiencing more common side effects like fatigue, migraines, and night sweats.
Yeah, thank you so much. So, you know, our diet really does change our biochemistry, and we're learning more and more about that through inflammation, through the microbiome. And so, number one, I think it's really finding the diet that works for you, and I'm finding more and more that there's not a one-size-fits-all for every patient. So one strategy is to really find out what are some of your food triggers, and we do that sometimes through elimination diets. And so you could even go and Google what is an elimination diet and do a simple elimination diet in conjunction with your healthcare provider team. Certainly an anti-inflammatory diet, which is basically a Mediterranean diet, and which is tons of fruits and veggies, more veggies than fruit, lots of omega-3 fatty acids, and we see through very large randomized controlled trials for cardiovascular disease that that actually impacts inflammation, and inflammation drives migraines and fatigue and pain, and so it can impact certainly your symptom burden and potentially your disease outcomes, and we're looking at those things now, is how does modulating the inflammation really change the disease pathobiology over time and the microbiome, which is also associated with it. And I could go on and on for the entire program, so I will stop there about diet.
Well, I should actually let everybody know that we do have a part three to this series on April 4th, and it's the role of nutrition, exercise, and meditation in coping with myeloproliferative neoplasms. So if you haven't signed up for this entire series, please do sign up for this one, because I think it may address some of the things that I think Dr. Gowan was trying to address as well. So I think that might be helpful for people. I have a question from one of our participants, and for Dr. Gerds. Is bleeding gums part of PV?
Well, excuse me. Thank you for that question. Yes, you know, the bleeding gums may or may not be, right? So there are lots of reasons for your gums to bleed, from periodontal disease or you know, tooth issues, of course. But patients can have bleeding gums for a lot of reasons that are hematologic. In the MPNs, we do know that there are intrinsic platelet dysfunction that occurs with the platelets, the particles in your blood that help your blood clot. That means that they may be normal in number, but they're not functioning normally. So that could certainly be a sign. Often our patients with MPNs are on aspirin as well, and combined with a little bit of gingival disease, that could lead to gum bleeding. In rare cases, we can see disease actually in the gum tissue. So this is a thing we see a little bit more often in something called acute myeloid leukemia, a related disease. But sometimes we can see bits of extramedullary hematopoiesis in the gums as well, which, again, is a very rare complication of myelofibrosis. So certainly there is an interplay. If the platelets are low or they're dysfunctional, we can see gum bleeding. And also aspirin can increase the risk of gum bleeding. Either way, it's important to collaborate with our dental colleagues to make sure that there's no gingival or tooth related type of disease that needs to be addressed, as well as, you know, inquiring how the platelets are functioning.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Bose, it's a little bit of a long question. I have ET, and my side effects were relatively mild when I started treatment, but they've recently started impacting my life in a manner that is no longer acceptable. I have a hard time with the feeling in my hands, and recently started having issues with blurry vision. How do I discuss this with my provider, and should I reach out for a second opinion?
Well, you know, it doesn't necessarily you know, tell us what they're on, but I'll make a few general points. So twice a day aspirin can help. A lot of the time, patients are asked to take once a day aspirin. And there's actually a few papers out there showing that aspirin works better if you give it twice a day, not two at the same time, but one baby aspirin twice a day can help with some of the microvascular symptoms that I think were mentioned in the question. And again, I'm not sure what is the current treatment. Hydroxyurea is perhaps the most common, but interferons are an alternative. They do help with symptoms, but that's, I would not call them call that their strong point, their strength. If symptoms are the main issue, I think the best drug, even though not approved for ET, might be ruxolitinib. There's been studies showing symptom benefits with ruxolitinib, and I think there are certain symptoms that Rux perhaps addresses better than anything else. Again, it's not approved for ET, but obtainable. I have several patients where their insurance is supporting the off-label use of ruxolitinib. And then there can be side effects, right? Like sometimes, you know, people with ET may be on anagrelide, which lowers the platelets very nicely, but can cause significant side effects with tachycardia, edema, headaches, et cetera. So again, some general answers there, but hopefully some useful suggestions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And a question from Dr. Gerz. What is the likelihood of receiving a stem cell transplant for myelofibrosis? What does this process entail?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and I feel silly answering this with Dr. Gowan on the call, as she's done some of the similar work looking at transplant for myelofibrosis. The process is quite simple. We do use chemotherapy to weaken the recipient's immune system, and chemotherapy can clean up disease, but it's really the donor's immune system. So as a transplant recipient, immune system has allowed this cancer to grow. And that's one of our natural protections against cancer, and it's allowed it to grow. So what we do is we take out that faulty immune system and put a new immune system in you to go and fight the cancer, and that's really how transplant works. And so the process itself, though, is that we use chemotherapy and or radiation to weaken the immune system to kind of make a hole, if you will, for the new immune system to grow. And so we put the cells in. They know where to go. They go into the vein. They home into the bone marrow and start to grow a new bone marrow and immune system. And that takes a little bit of time. And we use immunosuppressants to kind of help with that recovery to prevent graft rejection and this complication of the transplant called graft versus host disease, where the new immune system attacks the organs we don't want it to. Through that period of time, you often need transfusions as well to support the body as the bone marrow grows back. So it's very different than a solid organ transplant. But again, like I mentioned, it is the only treatment that we have available that is potentially curative for patients with myelofibrosis or any MPN.
Excellent, thank you. And now we're just going to kind of wrap up the program. I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway from today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Gerz, then Dr. Bose, Dr. Gowan. So just a kind of minute or so takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Yeah. I think just to steal from what Dr. Gowan and Dr. Bose has already said, I think the key take home is, you know, these diseases are kind of unique and individual, and it always is worth it to get a second opinion. You know, you guys are taking the first step by joining in today and learning more about these diseases. But, I think going and getting a second opinion is so critical. I have plenty of anecdotes to talk about, but we don't have any time. But I couldn't be more supportive of combining your forces, you, your local doctor, and an MPN expert somewhere, and all working together to deliver the best care.
And do you want to comment about the experts? How do people find them, or what is the...
Absolutely. There are some online resources, of course. Things like MPN Advocacy and International have lists of folks who focus on MPNs. The Myeloproliferative Neoplasm Research Foundation also has lists available you can view. I know I get a lot of patients referred to me from social media, such as Facebook. There's a large Facebook group that exists out there for patients with MPNs. And a patient may say, hey, I want to get a second opinion. I live in the middle of the country, I might be recommended in that instance as well as an MPN expert. So I think those are the kind of most common ways people do find MPN experts, or even just ask your doc. The doc you're seeing likely knows someone in the area that specializes in MPNs that you could go potentially see.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Bose?
Yeah, so, you know, again, I think this has been another very, very enjoyable and hopefully useful and productive webinar. You know, these diseases are different fundamentally from most other cancers in the sense that, one, as Dr. Gerds alluded to, you're not treating for a certain stage. There is no stage. You know, we're treating primarily based on trying to prevent a certain outcome, which could be, say, clots or, or in myelofibrosis, you know, addressing a certain symptom, spleen, anemia. So, they have different hallmarks. They're quite heterogeneous. And really, each patient is different, and symptoms are extremely important. So I'm glad that that was the theme, so to speak, of today's discussion, because it's again, so much of it is subjective and not that readily measured. And again, as Dr. Gawin was alluding to earlier, there are things that pharmacologic therapies cannot do very well, and lifestyle interventions are particularly important in this setting. And finally, again, just to reiterate what Dr. Gerds said, you know, these are rare diseases. You know, rare diseases, and so again, there's no offense at all to your local physician if this is not something they are super comfortable with. And therefore, I think trying to see an MPN expert as well in your part of the country, together with your local hemonc, is probably the way to go.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Bose. That was terrific. Thank you. And Dr. Gawin.
Yeah, well, I'd like to end the call with just conveying how exciting of a time it really is for MPNs, that we have many new therapeutics in the pipeline that are exciting. They're combination strategies, which are novel. They're now disease-modifying, which is extremely important. Not only are we addressing blood counts and risk for blood clots and symptoms, but now we're actually changing the course of the disease, and that is really, really exciting. And then I'd like to also end with just empowering everyone on the call that through knowledge, really understanding the disease and understanding the resources out there, understanding how to track symptom burden and how to communicate symptom burden really will empower your success with this journey on the MPN path, as well as empowering lifestyle medicine, of course, that you are then in the driver's seat to really contribute to your healthcare team and your overall wellness. So thank you so much. It's been such an honor to spend time with you, Dr. Messner, Dr. Gerds, Dr. Bose. You're all amazing.
Well, and so are you, Dr. Cohen. It's been amazing. I have to say that our speakers today have been absolutely amazing. And our participants also have asked such great questions as well. And I think that we hope that you've learned quite a bit from this program, and that you will take what you've learned back to your treating healthcare team. So for those of you who had the opportunity to ask a question, for those of you who are in queue hoping to have asked a question, but we couldn't get to all the questions of everybody on the call, and for those of you who are thinking of a question you'd like to ask, all of you go back to your treating healthcare team and ask the question. And I think our speakers have discuss the possibility of you're seeking a second opinion, if indeed you're seeing someone who may not be an MPN expert, but is a community physician who is someone that you know and are comfortable with, but perhaps there is someone that they would be able to recommend as an expert in with MPNs, with your particular type of MPN for you to see, and they would work with you. And actually, there are what we call the National Cancer Institute designated centers of excellence, and they actually work, it is part of their mandate to work with community physicians on cancers that, well, rare cancers, but all cancers that they may be treating. So that basically that's a takeaway for all of you to know that you can speak to your physician and that that second opinion person that you see will work with your physician, particularly if you live in an area that is far away from seeing someone who's an MPN expert. Also, I would recommend, and I think we know that it's come up in the call, that it's important to know the phone numbers of your healthcare team, well, your physician, actually, your MPN physician. It seems like things always seem to happen weekends, evenings, and holidays. So always check with them when you see them again. What are the numbers to call on weekends, evenings, and holidays? Because that always seems to trip people up. Also, we don't want you to leave this call feeling that you're alone. We want you to now know that you're part of a community of support. We're all here to help you. And we do have another program coming up that we hope that you'll all be participating in as well. You'll be getting information about that. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.